The Ship of Theseus, also known as the Theseus Paradox, is a thought experiment that raises the question of whether an object that has had all its components replaced remains fundamentally the same object. The paradox is most notably recorded by Plutarch in The Life of Theseus from the late 1st century. What is our identity? How do we know who or what we are? Is reality merely the unique combination of electrical impulses firing between billions of neurons? Does our existence and identity, and possibly even soul, have the capability of transcending time and space untethered from the squishy gray matter between our ears? These questions and more arise when we consider a future where very large language model AIs and access to petabytes of information may be as commonplace as smartphones and laptops are today. Welcome to episode 5 of the Richest Family Podcast, Quantum Immortality, Agents with False Memories, and the Ship of Theseus. In this week's podcast, Magnetic Stripper, Greg Coles, and Clay Tantor, that's me, three lifelong Gen X weirdos, explore ideas about what is the meaning of identity? Can our identities be hacked to remove our agency? And ask some difficult questions about disembodied consciousness. So glad you joined us. Here we go. We have with us, as usual, Magnetic Stripper, Greg Coles, and Clay Tantor. That's me. We're lifelong Gen X weirdos, friends from 20 years, talking pretty much the same kind of shit as we're going to talk about today. And I want to start this out with Jim, but he's got a disclaimer he usually does, and I'm going to add a little plus one disclaimer afterwards. Jim, what should people not think about when they listen to our Jim Jab?
The first thing they should come to grips with is that this is an extrapolation of what we do all the time anyway, right? So we're basically bullshitting our asses off here, and about a kernel of 5% truth in there somewhere. No, actually, this one has a little bit more philosophical roots to it. And I would recommend people doing their own research and coming to their own conclusions. But, you know, do you really know yourself? Do you really know what's real, Clay?
That's what we're going to talk about today. I mean, right. The plus one I want to add to that is that it is a privilege to be able to think and consider these things. We're very, you know, privileged in that we've been able to do this our whole lives. And so I would just say that anyone who is listening, we aren't going to try to make this some sort of, it's not an educational podcast. It's not, this isn't, a highly edited. This is three people enjoying discussion with each other about things that we think about all the time. And so it might wander. The topics may not, like, the way we deal with topics may not be perfectly crisp. That's not what we're trying to accomplish here. So just keep that in mind also.
You know, in the hills of Tennessee, Clay, they have a saying. Teaching is done with a book, but learning is done with a boot. And so this is way more about learning somebody than about teaching somebody.
Absolutely.
Right? Which sure. Has all the baggage of that attached, which sure. Means that basically, you know, when somebody learns you something, 99% of the time it's wrong.
But Jim, you know, when we kind of started riffing on this, some of the things that you found, I think in kind of a core kind of historical reference is this idea of the Ship of Theseus. What was the Ship of Theseus? Can you explain a little bit why it's this paradigm and sure. You know, that kind of stuff?
Sure. So Theseus goes over, to deal with the Minotaur and with the Minotaur and deal with the labyrinth and all of this mission. Well, they took a ship over to Crete, right? And so when they come back, the ship is, revered as part of this heroic legacy. And so as it's sitting there, parts of it start falling apart and are replaced. And so you get to X number of years later, and the entire ship has been replaced. So,
is it the same ship? I mean, how did that happen? Was there, like, shipmakers following it around, or what?
Well, in this case, there's various traditions of this, like one where it kind of goes from port to port. The one that's kind of done by Plutarch is that it comes into port and is basically maintained like a statue in the port, right? So it's on display.
Checked out.
But anything like a ship above water starts disintegrating, right?
Yes.
It's one of the things that happens. It's like ships are supposed to be in the water. When they're out of the water, they start rotting. And so basically being set next to the ocean,
laying
it starts
solid.
Falling apart. And so people start reconstructing it. Which is interesting, the concept of, is it the same ship? Right? Because it doesn't have any of the original parts at the end.
Well, it seems symbolic of the superego. That as you're aging, you're gaining the voices of your parents, your teachers, your friends, and then, you know, at which point was the original baby voice, you know?
Exactly, or the cells in your body, the fact that you've turned over.
That's the one
are
I've
you
heard.
The same person?
Yeah, that's the one I've heard the most, like, that, yeah. Like every cell in your body dies and doesn't have more than a 7-year longevity, and so essentially, as you get older, you're being replaced by a new you that's a, you know.
Oh, sure. Right? Let's take this one step further, though. So I believe it's Thomas Hobbes. I mean, somebody could fact check me here out in the audience, but I believe it's Thomas Hobbes came up with a quandary that's kind of, well, what if somebody picked up all the pieces that, you know, the ship rights were, you know, removing in order to fix it, and then built a ship out of the original pieces, since this first one is scrapped down to,
right,
you know, nothing. If it's reconstructed, which one is the real one?
Yeah. And that, you know, comes up in, like, all these people who are into brain upload technology. They say, well, you would destroy the original brain once you transferred it. And I'm like, oh, really?
What about a cutting from a tree? What about a cutting from a tree?
Right, right.
You know, you take a cutting from a tree and get it to root. At a certain point, what if that that cutting ends up being more like the original tree than the dying real tree? It kind of becomes this, you know, it's a principle of identity. And
right.
I guess that's
so
what
I think
we're
that's
really
the thing.
Talking about here.
Yeah, identity is an important aspect of this. And in Buddhism, there's a concept of no identity or no self, and how, you know, the idea of identity is a grasping activity. So that's, to me, you know, really interesting that some of our religions have tried to transcend that, right? So you also, like, I've heard of this concept called the Boltzmann brain. And the idea of the Boltzmann brain is that it's a brain that is just kind of spontaneously has an identity.
Yeah.
Like, how do we know we're not one of those now is kind of the interesting question around that, right?
Ludwig Boltzmann's like this kind of interesting character. You know, anybody who hangs himself on vacation, definitely.
Oh, he did that?
He didn't just hang himself. He hung himself while on vacation with his family.
Well, fun times.
Yeah,
fun
the free
times,
time.
Exactly.
Killed him, right?
Yeah. So basically, he is one of these characters that's involved with, you know, mathematics, physics. His big thing was, second law of thermodynamics. And so he gets into this kind of visualization process where he ends up saying, you know, it's more possible for a brain, a fully cognizant brain, to just spontaneously generate than it is for our universe to have come from just an a pinpoint explosion or whatever, a big bang. And so his argument was
that the brain is more likely to have spontaneously, like, that we, the brain having a memory of being alive and existing, is more likely than the universe spontaneously doing that.
Yeah.
And, right. I see what you mean.
Yeah. So that gets all kinds of crazy, because he actually came up with a huge number, like 10 to the 56th, 24th, or something huge number. Which longer than the universe has existed.
Yeah, some things have a precedence, and the other is 0 to 1, right?
Whereas
consciousness, there's multiple forms of consciousness before you start talking about like chimps, dolphins, humans, you know.
Okay, well let's talk about this in terms of spontaneous. I don't exactly know what that means in terms of physics, because what is spontaneous to one frame is millennia to another. So is our consciousness that we're exhibiting right now a proof of a certain type of Boltzmann brain? You know, like is the self-referential, it's completely outside of the philosophical. Like, for example, solipsists, people who are brain in a jar kind of people. Like, I'm making everything up. This is all an emanation. Well, even that is a proof of this, because it had to come from somewhere. And is that frame of time close enough to spontaneous?
Right.
Well, but then then when it's the brain observing itself, it's like, how much of that is an intellectual self-deception versus an actual observation?
Oh man, you know? That's what we're talking about today.
Yeah. It's hard to make those sort of.
Let's talk about something. We're talking about agents with false memories, which is something that I found. It was a record title or a band title by the late Richard H. Kirk from Cabaret Voltaire. And I'm like, what is an agent with a false memory? And then I started researching false memories, which I'm sure you guys know some things about, including MKUltra experiments and...
Before we start riffing on... let's see if we can cover a little bit of background about this thing that we're referencing now, the Canadian experiments and the Stanford experiments. And, you know, let's maybe create a
what's the background you want to bring, Greg?
Let's talk about first the Stanford experiments, which in my opinion were a little less severe. This was in the 60s. Let me see. I've got a bit here. Maybe I could just read it off of the trellis.
Yeah, there you go.
Let me see if I can find it.
Oh, before you go, Greg.
I'm looking for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting that there wasn't just MKUltra. There was also MKDelta and a couple of other programs and sub-programs. In fact, the one that happens in Canada is a sub-program of maybe both of those.
The Montreal experiments were a series of experiments initially aimed to treat schizophrenia by changing memories and erasing the patient's thoughts using Donald Ewan Cameron's method of psychic driving. And I've got a thing on the Korean assassin.
Yeah.
I found the Stanford experiment.
Okay, go ahead.
Greg.
Sure,
Before you go. There's another term, if people want to research this a little bit. The term was depatterning. Is what was going on in Montreal. And there's some videos of people who went through the process, and they have very interesting characteristics to their post-treatment personalities. Okay, Greg, sorry, man.
All right, sure. Okay, the Stanford Prison Experiment was a psychological experiment conducted in the summer of 1971. It was a two-week simulation of a prison environment that examined the effects of situational variables on participants' reactions and behaviors. Stanford University psychology professor Philip Zimbardo, he had a TV show for a while, led the research team who administered the study. Guy looks like fucking Dracula when you see a picture of him. Participants were recruited from the local community with an ad in the newspapers offering $15 a day, it's all these fucking hippies, to male students who wanted to participate in a psychological study of prison life. Volunteers were chosen after assessments of psychological stability and then randomly assigned to be prisoners or prison guards. Critics have questioned the validity of these methods, just as random fucking bullshit. Those volunteers selected to be guards were given uniforms specifically to de-individuate them. So just kind of standard faceless dude, and instructed to prevent prisoners from escaping. The experiment officially started when prisoners were arrested by Real Palo police. Oh, geez, I didn't realize this. Over the following 5 days, psychological abuse of the prisoners by the guards became increasingly brutal. After psychologist Christina Maslisch visited to evaluate the conditions, she was upset to see how study participants were behaving, and she confronted Zimbardo. He ended the experiment on the sixth day. SPE, the Stanford experiment, has been referenced and critiqued as one of the most unethical psychological experiments in history. The harm inflicted on the participants prompted universities worldwide to improve their ethics requirements for human subjects of experiments to prevent from being similarly harmed. Other researchers found it difficult to reproduce the study, given those constraints. Critics have described the study as unscientific and fraudulent.
Great.
And
okay.
We have.
Yeah, so what's the... You're making a connection of that to MKUltra, so how is that being connected in your mind?
So this is actually, judging by the timeline, is going concurrently with MKUltra, but this has nothing to do with... this is, you know, Philip Zimbardo is an ethical person. You know, I've seen his TV show, I've read one of his books. He's genuinely interested in helping people, but he's just freeballing it. You know, I'm sure he himself was a young professor who's just feeling like, these hippies are just clay, you know, just here, give them a free lunch and let's just slap this shit together.
Jim, you have a video on the Canadian program, the MKUltra program. Can I play that video real quick?
Sure.
That the Soviets had developed rather esoteric and unusual methods of so-called brainwashing people. The purge trials...
Dr. John Gittinger was the CIA's chief psychologist for 25 years.
There was continued pressure put upon anybody within the agency in connection with trying to explain or understand brainwashing. So we were charged with rather an elaborate attempt to try to find out chemical, psychological, any kind of means that people could use to influence the behavior of the people.
I'm not getting it.
Okay. So what's the significance of that, Jim?
I couldn't hear that at all.
I think you won't hear it.
The stream will.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a guide video that was produced actually by, Canadian television to talk about what was going on because, you know.
Was it in Canada?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the thing that gets kind of convoluted about it is that this research is being partially bankrolled by the CIA. Mm-hmm. And is being done in Canada to sort of skirt around any kind of backlash from doing this on United States citizens.
Yeah, these were not volunteers. These were just patients at a regular hospital.
At a regular hospital, and it was
They're
done in conjunction.
They're not criminals or volunteers or anything like that.
And they had no knowledge of the work that was being done on them, so it's Precisely. Highly unethical.
Yes. Kind
of.
Well, I mean, okay, so this gets into a whole other here. So we can say things like, say you don't forget your dreams the way that you are supposed to as a regular human being. If you remembered all of your dreams, you would have issues. Mm-hmm. The fact that you forget them is part of the mechanics of your mind. And there's a reason, because it's supposed to be eliminating information out of short-term memory and plugging it into long-term memory. A problem that can occur is when someone remembers very vividly sections of dreams and then conflates those with reality, right? So this can be written into memory as being true.
Right.
Okay.
So this is wait a second. Let me see if I'm hearing the connection. The connection I'm hearing is as one might write your memories into a synthetic brain so that you can upload your consciousness into this, you know, this artificial brain. Those techniques are influenced by what was learned during psychic driving and MKUltra.
Okay, so when you
am I on the right track?
What I'm saying is you have one level where you have false memories, right? That are created either by implantation, suggestion, imagination. These things create false memories. What happens with the experiments that went on in Canada is they wiped people's minds all the way down to the tabula rasa, the blank slate. They completely eliminate. In fact, they had to teach them to walk again. They had to teach them how to use the bathroom again.
Let's talk about some of the things that they used to do that. Sleep deprivation, massive doses of LSD,
yep.
Loudspeakers going Chirari. Constantly. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Extremely
and so
stressful
they
conditions.
They would put people... They would put, oh, they would put people under. This was a major one. They would put people under. And then...
Electric shock therapy, they would do ECT.
Yeah.
I've got a good GIF of that.
Yeah,
I've got
I'm
a good
GIF right
of electric shock therapy.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it.
Do ECT while they were under with strobe lights on them, all this crazy shit. And the side effect of it was you had somebody on the other side that had no idea who they were. So that is an interesting way. Okay, so... How about
I
this question?
I think I need
okay,
my but, EST.
What if you were a criminal? What if you were a criminal? You've done this crime, and you are wiped down to zero. Are you still the criminal?
Well, I don't think it's going to be that clear cut.
Well, it's back to the ship of Theseus. I mean, that's exactly what that is, right?
Let me talk about the MKUltra's involvement in this, because, I mean, before MKUltra, this is just psychology experiments with some hippies in a fucking college, right? It's not too much affecting real shit. But look at Manchurian Candidate, Zoolander. This is what we're talking about, turning someone into a weapon. You know,
yeah.
There were. It was brought about by prisoners of war in North Korea, who were put to it. Man, their brains were fucking crushed. Sleep deprivation for long periods of time. Drug intensity.
You don't
torture.
Even have to do that, though. What?
Right.
So,
right.
I want to show this Korean assassin thing, but I think it plays into this because.
The Manchurian Candidate has a lot of real clues.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The conditioning, the triggering, and how it's being built on an already robust psychological profile.
That's one way. There's also another way, which is tell someone what they're doing as their identity, even though it's fishy and weird, is... natural and normal. And so that's
right.
What happened. That's what happened in Korea with this woman. Basically what the Korean Secret Service did with her was they basically, she was an influencer in Asia, a Vietnamese influencer who did pranks. You know, you've seen these on Instagram and YouTube, these pranksters, and she very kind of simple kinds of pranks, like she would walk up to strangers and put Vaseline on their face and then film their reaction, you know. And so all they had to do with her is replace the Vaseline with something else. And so here, I want to read this really quick. This is really good, and show the pictures. So as he ambled past a column, a back plaque slung over one shoulder, a woman approached him and wiped an oily substance on his face before disappearing. Her usual actions caught on CCTV. Moments later, another woman came from behind and covered his eyes with his hands. She then slid them down over his mouth, quickly apologizing, and walked away. Less than 20 minutes later, the man was dead. The victim was assassination carried out with nerve agent VX, one of the most deadly chemical weapons in the world. The killer, Dong Tai Hwan, says she was tricked into carrying out the attack by North Korean operatives who told them they were playing a prank for a Japanese comedy show. This is the guy. He was one of Kim Jong-il's enemies, political enemies. And this is her. She's like smiling. She doesn't have any idea what's going on.
Sure. That was the general workflow of the Cosa Nostra in New York and America. Was like, you know, and in the movies, we kind of, you know, think of like the professional assassin. The professional assassin didn't touch the gun. The professional assassin used his knowledge of human nature to find the susceptible tool to put the gun in his hand. What's his name? Who shot Kennedy? That's a perfect example. That's why that whole operation, to me, is a mafia operation. And there are many examples of the CIA subcontracting mafiosos to do operations because they were experts at that sort of inspiring someone to commit a crime.
Well, the thing
and then
here,
they become disposable.
The thing that was interesting in this is they didn't have to convince her. They didn't have to abduct her and wipe her mind and give her drugs.
Yes.
All they had to do was hack her identity and replace something she thought was normal in her identity with one element, and that's poison.
Yep.
They hacked her. And they did that in Ghost in the Shell, too. They hacked this dude, right? So he's out doing stuff on behalf of, when he with false memories. What happens when we can hack brains, right? And so I want to transition just a little bit. We're halfway through with the podcast.
Sure.
To this idea of people who believe that we can take our consciousness, like using these techniques, right? Because that's the foundation, and can upload their consciousness or use techniques. And you've got a whole thing, Greg, on mushrooms. I want to hear your tie-in with mushrooms. Can you talk a little bit about the
okay, let
the
me
whole
start
mushroom?
Off with one of the my little bits here. Let me see. I think I pumped something out of GPT. Okay, here, I'll just read a couple here. Okay, this is I've got a picture of like a caterpillar with some pulsating eye stalks.
Okay, great. I'll find it.
This is a Lusococcalordurium, a parasitic worm that invades a nail's eye stalks, where it pulsates to imitate a caterpillar. The worm then mind controls its hosts out into the open for hungry birds to pluck its eyes out. In the bird's guts, the worm breeds, releasing its eggs into the bird's feces, which are happily eaten up by another snail to complete the whole bizarre lifestyle. So this is another animal controlling this animal's own bodily functions for its own needs, you know, that are completely not good for the the host. And here, let's
I've heard that on. With fungus infecting hornets and ants also,
yeah, now he,
right?
Here,
toxoplasmosis and cordyceps, I think we were talking about.
Yes, or, here, I've got my thing about the cordyceps. Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, normally known as zombie ant fungus, is an insect pathogenic fungus discovered by British naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace in 1859 and currently found predominantly in tropical jungle ecosystems. Unilateralis infects ants of the tribe Campotini, with the full pathogenesis being characterized by an alteration of the behavioral patterns of the infected ant. Infected hosts leave their canopy nests and foraging trails for the forest floor, an area with a temperature and humidity suitable for fungal growth. The fungus is making them go to places that are good for the fungus. They then use their mandibles to attach themselves to a major vein on the underside of a leaf, death grip, where the host remains after its eventual death. The process ending up to mortality takes 4 to 10 days. And includes a reproductive stage where the fruiting bodies grow from the ant's head, rupturing to release the fungus's spores. Unilateralis is in turn also susceptible to fungal infections itself. Don't stop. An occurrence that can limit its impact on ant populations. So
wait a second. The fruiting body can have fruiting bodies?
Yes. So they're fighting each other for control of this poor ant.
Wow.
So are you seeing, like, I mean, are you seeing, like, zombies, human zombies infected by...
Let me read the last paragraph. Okay, this Orsidophe and related species are known to engage in an active secondary metabolism, among other reasons, for the production of substances active as antibacterial agents that protect the fungus host ecosystem, the zombie, from further pathogenesis, decomposing during fungal reproduction. So it's keeping this fucking ant alive, even though it's not eating, it's not doing all the things it needs to do. So one of the positive things from studying these cordyceps is the use of these anti-fungal agents that are keeping things alive. And then I'd like to reference Wade Davis, the writer of Serpent and the Rainbow, who went to study the zombie medication in Haiti and was dosed by it.
Was that fungal in nature? Or what is that related to the...
Well, it's, you know, this is a, once again, in Haiti is an example of these powerful chemicals being used for political, social ends.
Gotcha. You know, then that's the connection. It's just like,
right,
usurping one's own. And this is the anti-life equation, you know?
Right.
This is the...
Well, it starts with the...
human will, when we lose human will, right?
Well, the religious aspect, like psychologically preparing people for some controlled limbo existence. You know?
Gotcha. Hey, I've got a really cool video that kind of bridges to our next topic, which is around this brain jar uploaded psycho brain thing. And I watched RoboCop recently. And it goes into this quite a bit. Let's see if I can get this transitioned. Yeah, here we go.
I must go.
Go where? Do what? Go dancing, fall in love? What is it you think you are?
Alex Murphy.
That's a delusion. There's a glitch in your system. Alex Murphy is dead. You take away the plastic and metal and wires, and you're just a couple of chunks on a corner's table.
She's telling him that Alex Murphy doesn't exist. His identity doesn't matter.
What are you? Respond.
I'm Officer Alex Murphy.
He's fighting her with his brain. He's telling her, I'm Alex Murphy. And now she's typing words and downloading a new identity.
RoboCop. Crime Prevention Unit. OCP.
She's so proud of herself. He's lost either her his identity.
You type it, I think it.
What a wonderful opportunity you represent.
Oh, she's so smart. She's so smart. Look at her, how smug.
Slow, clumsy practice. Look at you. This is so simple.
Yeah.
Direct.
Anyway,
Can I just chime in on this concept?
Yeah.
The idea of like experiencing your personality through your human body versus some AI that is an accumulation of your thoughts and experience and is a simulation of your consciousness, it would be fundamentally different. Think of how different your personality is when you're hungry, tired, agitated, that, you know, would your optimal self be recognizable as
totally.
You without the foibles of your physical body, you know, in a way sort of holding you back, you know?
Totally.
Wait a second. Have you ever had a dream that was so real that when you woke up, you thought that was the dream?
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Okay. So this is one of the things that I've always said that the difference between reality and a simulation are just, it's kind of like just the levels of the stimulation, right? And so I think that if you experience something because of a stimulus, that it is indiscernible if it's done properly from the actual event.
Well, you were describing like dreams versus waking consciousness. And so much of dreams is trying to interpret data that is not immediately understandable, and often by combining known elements to fill in the gaps. And a pretty like harmless example was used in like showing people pictures of Bugs Bunny, showing people pictures of Disneyland, and then asking them about a trip they took to Disneyland, and did they see Bugs Bunny? Of course,
oh, yeah, it's
Warner
a
Brothers
test
character.
Memory.
Not a Disney can. They're like, oh yeah, yeah, I saw the stuffed guy, we hung out, right? Like, didn't happen, mm-hmm. couldn't happen, right? You know?
Yep.
And
that,
it's just through suggestion. You know,
and
we're
that goes back
that so
to this
much.
Whole
yeah, yeah.
mind driving thing, right?
Exactly.
So
right.
That's what I'm kind of getting at is, so we've learned techniques of injecting both identity and belief of that identity in history and past. And then if you add to that, you know, the ability to have very complex deep learning models that you could train and tons of data, now you're getting into the space of what the people who want to do, you know, live and be immortal through mind upload and quantum. So, Jim, you brought up a topic called quantum immortality. Let's briefly touch on that, because this our mortality thing to me is something that people really hang on to with brain in a jar stuff. And
sure. But I'm going to say something about your previous topic first.
Okay.
And that is, they've been doing some experiments where they utilize AI in order to interpret what people are seeing.
Sure.
So when somebody looks at a picture of a train, they then read different wave patterns. And then they use AI,
research.
And
yeah.
the output of it is suspiciously similar to what the input is.
Not only that, they're figuring out how to like read dreams. They put people in MRIs and they record all the data, and then they train an AI on that. So then they use predictive models of what when a new dream comes.
Well,
and they use that in combination with image generation, and the images that are coming out are very similar to the dreams people had.
Well, what I'm wondering, at what point is it going to be like the computer like coming to the just random actions of a normal human brain versus like mental disciplines? where we're learning to organize our thoughts in a structure that is accessible to an artificial model. Like, yeah. You know, like meeting it halfway.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, think about this. When you're making a film that has CGI and live action, one technique is to make your CGI look like the live action. Another technique is to make your live action come midway to your CG, right? Mm-hmm. So that is an interesting idea, is that the intersection between the artificial and the organic suddenly starts. You discipline the human mind, and then you crazify the computer model, you know, in order to get this balance between them, right?
Okay, Jim, you have back to the brain in the jar. You have this concept about quantum immortality, and what when you're talking about quantum immortality, what are you going on that?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we're talking about identity. So a question is, would it be possible for your identity to go on forever, even without the assistance of, external machinery, even without people telling stories about you or being written about? And a couple of physicists postulated that, you know, there's a thing called quantum suicide, where in a multiple reality, multiple universe interpretation of quantum mechanics, if you were to commit suicide, there were branches where it didn't happen, it didn't go through,
right.
something else happened.
The metaverse bifurcation. Can I play that video? You put a video on that. There we go.
Fantastic Wikipedia list called Wikipedia : Unusual Articles. It's filled with unusual, unexpected, and unbelievable subjects. Every other week, I click on a new link and teach you a little bit.
Can you tell me
more.
Where this...
Well, if Wolverine or Deadpool tell you anything, you don't. But there's a theory on how you can. It's gonna need a bit of explanation. So if you're like this guy and don't enjoy long-winded answers, I suggest you turn off the video now.
Oh, it's kind
of... Quantum mechanics. They're complicated.
Okay, this is kind of in-depth. I don't want to spend too much time on a video.
No, it's just a reference video.
Okay, so... How would you TLDR that?
Pardon?
How would you summarize that?
I would summarize it in saying that basically through all these paths, you end up going on and on and on forever, because there's always a path where you survive because of some kind of development. Some kind of
all possibilities are
all
there.
The possibilities.
And so on some path, you are immortal.
You are immortal.
Gotcha.
But this is a crazy thing, because that also means that your identity, let's say that you met up in some strange universe with a copy of yourself.
Okay.
So, which one is the real you?
That would be very confusing. Yeah.
Right.
Would.
So,
can I
mention something about what Jim just said? Just,
sure.
Just, so now we are in an age where we are identifying pretty strongly with ourselves as individuals, less so with group identities. And I don't think that was necessarily the case through history. That often, you know, we were part of a dynasty, part of a clan, part of a village, and the way our own concerns were almost secondary. And I can kind of see a return to that with these sort of hive mind activities, where like an ant, you know, the individual is just concerned about, you know, making the goal happen, and his own concerns become secondary.
Yeah.
Well, they become cellular.
Well,
yes, they become just drive, like hunger.
If we say that the future is a projection of the present, what do we see in terms of trends of the behavior of society and culture? To my mind, what I see is more people drifting apart than they are hearts bonded and coming together, and that they might belong to seven different micro cults that have completely different interests, and but they're relatively isolated emotionally and spiritually and communally and culturally. They're at home on the internet, and that's their connection. They're not actually seeing people face to face. I mean,
yes.
I don't get to see you guys face to face as much as I would like, right? And that's happening more and more and more. And when I look at the brain in the jar, I see it as a furtherment of that trend of us to self-isolate. And that the only connections I want to you need to be electronic. I'm a brain in a box. I don't need to fuck. I don't need to eat dinner with you or ask. I take what I need from you when I need it electronically, and it's very intellectually appealing. And I think that is a giant threat and a fallacy. Just as you mentioned, I get hangry. I don't know about you. I do. And this idea that we could take our brains out of our bodies and still be the same human is a fucking lie.
Yeah, we wouldn't be the same person. We would be something else. Yes.
That's right. That's right.
Well, you look at, like, some of these authors who were, like, tremendous human beings in their books, and they were, like, you know, heavy drinkers. They beat their kids. You know, like, Alan Watts is a perfect example. You read his books, you're like, right. Dude, this guy's an angel. You know, and I knew someone was
his
neighbor.
I love listening to him.
Yeah. Right. I knew someone who was his neighbor in Santa Cruz, and they just said, yeah, he was a creep, man. His kids were a fucking mess. You know, he was just a fucking drinker who was, you know, just wanted to spend all the time fucking writing and was just not a dad at all.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you look at the fucking feet of clay, you know, I'm sorry, right. Not your feet.
I know what you mean. It's the golem, right? The golem has feet of clay,
well, okay,
right?
Okay, so we're talking about this in terms of a very kind of late 20th century, early 21st century. What do you think would happen if there was a major collapse in our system whereby people could not operate as individuals at all? And we became basically more like mole rats or like ants inside THX 1138.
We're already seeing that. We're already seeing that. Look at the huge homeless population. They can't function in modern society. They can't.
Yeah.
It's too cold. I mean, without my wife, man, I would have problems functioning.
They're displaced.
Right?
A lot of these people are displaced. You know, like, what do you do if your job has been replaced by machinery? And this went on, you know, in the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
Yes,
absolutely. Well, what I'm seeing as the only solution is you're going to have every baby assigned an AI who is going to be their fucking super ego. Who's going to be like, no, Davey.
That's the real nanny state.
And
right?
It will be indistinguishable from their own mind if they're growing up with this shit, right?
Okay, so talking about identity, do you think the morality of imprinting from essentially birth, do you think that this is, because in certain circumstances, it might be more humane than letting somebody be a free radical inside of the system?
Hey, making kids go to school, right? Is anybody complaining about
that?
That's what that is. Yeah, right. You know, hey, a technology, right? Give them a calculator, give them a laptop, give them a fucking thing. What's going to be the next step, right? You know, if it makes kids easier to learn,
is it more about teaching people or more about conditioning? Because that's another thing. It's like installing basically a not a, b beyond the superego, it's basically installing kind of an OS that runs inside of the society.
Well, precisely. That's what I was talking about, having to meet it halfway. It's like, hey, you're sitting in a classroom and jumping and freaking out and throwing rocks. Hey, that's what kids do naturally, right? But you got to modify nature to be an interface for the bigger thing, right?
So,
if you're throwing your feces, you're not learning to read.
So, so imagine a world or a where many, maybe even mostly elite individuals who have the wealth to pursue immortality attempt to do this, right? And when, you know, basically when we talk about mind imploding and what it is, here's what Wiki kind of summarizes it as. Mind uploading is a speculative process of whole brain emulation, in which a brain scan is used to completely emulate the mental state of the individual in a digital computer. The computer would then run the simulation of the brain's information processing such that it would respond in essentially the same way as the original brain. The simulated mind could be within a virtual reality or a simulated world, or supported by an anatomic 3D body like in Peripheral. Or, alternatively, the simulated mind could reside in a computer, and that's another model, like our AIs are in the virtual reality, the Matrix. There's a version of us that lives there, or a robot or biological cybernetic body.
Can I just chime in a second? So, at this point, you know, so much of our brain is geared towards, like, making our legs move, making our food digest. And that if our brains were these interdependent entities, we wouldn't think about just making a mechanical facsimile that shits batteries. We would be thinking of these way more complex ways of interfacing to be more efficient, like insect societies, network.
I don't know. I think we're pretty, like, we'll hang on. Like, we still drive new cars that look like classic cars, right? There'll be a lot of nostalgia. We're pretty fucking hooked on nostalgia.
Well, but, like, compare, like, someone who can read to someone who can't read. And just the way that their brains work. Like, for instance, like, someone who's used to reading fiction. Not even anything, like, technical. But just, like, used to, like, first-person narrative. A person who's illiterate struggles to imagine what's going on in someone else's head. Whereas if you read novels, you're like, oh, this is like this character. Oh, is, you know, you have a reference system. And I think you're going to have that when someone grows up with, like, their thinking structure having a filing system versus just throwing rocks and running.
Hey, there's a really good, like, in Ghost in the Shell.
Sure.
There's a really good... where they talk about this, and it's like one of the most famous scenes. Ingredients
that make up the yeah, it seems right what we're talking about
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
The components
yeah.
that
make up me as an individual with my own
personality. Sure, I have a face. Yeah, because I know she really struggles others, with, like, her present identity versus, like, and you know, the remnants of the human parts of her identity, and then trying to find a middle ground.
Okay, hang on one second. Sure. Hang on one second, Greg. I'm going to replay it, because...
There are countless ingredients that make up the human body and mind, like all the components that make up me as an individual with my own personality. Sure, I have a face and voice to distinguish myself from others, but my thoughts and memories are unique only to me, and I carry a sense of my own destiny. Each of those things are just a small part of it. I collect information to use in my own way. All of that blends to create a mixture that forms me and gives rise to my conscience. I feel confined, only free to expand myself within boundaries.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And I know you can't hear it, but it's... You've probably seen the scene. It's where she's talking about how she brings in information and grows awareness being a cybernetic brain is basically it, right? So
you look at like the different species of mammals that are the most intelligent: primates, dolphins, crows, you know, and it's all growing out of social interaction. So we're really seeing that these higher intellectual functions are based on interactions. And I think that's we're going to see the untapped aspects of the human mind coming out as our ability to interact with other people increases.
But don't you think we will be, like, this goes back to my whole thing. I think we're obsessed with nostalgia. I think if we're capable of taking consciousnesses and putting them into simulations, that, like, as a society, we'll just go into this loop of bringing back people from the past, like Britney Spears or Nixon, right? We'll want, I mean, here's the Futurama.
Oh, no. Well, listen,
Nixon.
Here, Missy. Computers may be twice
you
as
know,
fast
I think
as they were in
1973. In a way, we are biased.
But your average
because
voter is as drunk and stupid as ever.
And
the only one who's changed
in the
is
past.
Me. I've become
man,
bitter.
Now these
and
kids
let's face
grown
it,
up
crazy
with
over
phones,
the years.
Man,
and once I'm swept into office, I'll sell our children's organs to zoos for meat. And I'll go into people's houses at night and rack up the place.
It just doesn't exist. To them, like, the Depression and the Roman Empire happened at the same fucking time. It's like, oh, it was black and white then, right?
That is one thing
Futurama gets perfect is this whole idea that you get 50 years, 30 years, 20 years, 10 years, 5 years outside of it, and the ability to actually synchronize the events properly becomes increasingly more disjointed. But what's funny is that now we're at a stage where it happens with just a few years in the past.
So,
you know, it's desynchronized.
I think there was even the Futurama with Theseus, so that's kind of a good tie back. We're kind of at the top of the hour, and okay. I just want any kind of last thoughts any of you guys want to give before we part ways?
I had a lot of fun, and you know, there are so many tangents that we didn't take on our materials today. I'm hoping we are able to touch on them. Even so many things from our previous talks, I see touched on the things we talked about today. That
is
just
there
wonderful
a big
seeing
picture
all this thing
you
want to
kind of like.
We're just really seeing the evolution of consciousness, and I feel really privileged to live at a time when I could actually see the steps and be aware of them. Because so often people in the past are like, man, you lived on a farm, you know, you heard about some shit that happened a couple years ago, you know, you died of something, you didn't know what it was, you know. So just being able to have at least even some kind of handle on what's going on is such a privilege.
Well, even the Julian James thing, where we're just now capable of understanding that it's us that's doing the thinking, right?
Yeah.
Like the bicameral mind thing, you know, just like saying, oh, wow, that thought that I just had, that was my thought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even that is a revolution.
Right. The higher self being able to see the parts of the self and the third person is kind of a crucial part.
Self-referential.
Yeah, and it's the part of, like, in the Illuminati of being, having awareness and having the higher level intelligence that allows us to start getting into these abstract thought parts. So, I think we need to tie it up
with that.
I just want to tell you guys both how much I love you and how glad you guys aren't brains in a jar. And I wish I could see you both more face-to-face more often because I love you guys so much.
I bid 30 quatlus.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm a head in a rectangle.
Well, you look great doing it. Okay, guys, that's it for episode 5.
All right, tons of fun.
Lots of fun. And we'll see you next time.
Yowza!
Bye, guys.
Thanks for joining us for another amazing episode of The Richest Family. We hope that it made you think about weird stuff or at least reconsider something you felt like you already knew. You can also watch the video recording of this podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@ClayTantor. It would also really help us if you went to the YouTube channel and you liked and subscribed. We're trying to grow this channel so that people can share in this experience, so your help is appreciated. Or watch a stream live on twitch.tv/ClayTantor every other Sunday at 10 a.m. PST. Please tell your friends about this podcast. We're available on all streaming platforms, including Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcasts, all for free. So thanks for showing up. Glad you're here, and hope you have a strange and interesting day.